In the grim darkness of the far future, even death isn't the escape you'd hope for. The galaxy of Warhammer 40,000 is a place where hope is a rare commodity, and that includes hope for a pleasant afterlife. We have to ask, is there a paradise waiting beyond the ceaseless war? When daily life is so horrific, the promise of something better after death might be the only thing keeping you sane. So, is there a paradise in the 41st millennium's afterlife? Well, brace yourself, because the answer is as twisted as a chaos ritual. Every faction, every culture and species has its own ideas, or lack thereof, about what happens to you after you kick the bolter shell, so to speak. Prophets, preachers, warlords, and alien hive minds each have their own spin on the fate of the soul. From the devout billions of the Imperium to the enigmatic Eldar, from the savage orcs to the ravenous Tyranids, everyone has a story to tell about life after death. Some promise glory, others threaten eternal damnation, and a few just shrug and carry on. Today, we're peeling back the veil on those stories. We'll dive into the grim afterlife of Warhammer 40K as each faction sees it, or desperately hopes it to be. We'll see the grand promises, the comforting lies, and the harsh truths of what awaits the dead in a galaxy of perpetual war. By the end of this journey, you might just be thankful to stay alive as long as possible, because in the far future, paradise is often just another word for perpetual war. Let's start with the Imperium of Man, the vast galaxy-spanning human empire. Imagine you're an ordinary Imperial citizen or a humble guardsman fighting on some emperor-forsaken battlefield. You've been taught from birth that the God Emperor of Mankind is your savior, not just in life, but in death as well. The official Imperial Creed whispers of a glorious afterlife. If you live and die faithfully, your soul will be taken up by the Emperor's light. We are one with the Emperor. Our souls are joined in his will, as the old hymn goes. It's comforting, isn't it? The thought that when the last guns stop firing and your blood soaks into the mud, your spirit will rise to the Emperor's side, like a shining beacon in the warp. In Imperial propaganda, this afterlife might even sound like a grand army assembling in heaven, a celestial muster of noble souls, forever protected by the Golden Throne. Imperial propaganda leans heavily on this promise. Commissars and preachers bellow it in the trenches. The Emperor protects. Give your life gladly, for death in his service is not the end. In the pamphlets and war sermons, the afterlife is depicted almost like a patriotic paradise. The Emperor sits upon a radiant throne in the warp, the spiritual realm, and all who are loyal and true will join him there. There, it is said, the faithful will know only his warmth and guidance. Maybe you will even get to keep fighting the good fight alongside angelic warriors and saints, smiting demons in the Emperor's name for eternity. It's a bit like a war-torn version of heaven. Think of it as Valhalla meets boot camp, with the God Emperor as your eternal drill sergeant, though a kind one hopes. Of course, that's the official line. The truth, as usual, is more complicated and far darker. The Warhammer 40K universe runs on grim reality, not happy endings. You see, when an Imperial citizen dies, what actually happens is that their soul slips into the warp. And the warp is not a friendly place. It's a seething, howling sea of psychic energy, full of predatory entities. The Emperor's loyal followers believe their souls will be safe in his hands. And perhaps sometimes they are. There are stories of brave Imperial martyrs and saints whose spirits are said to have been saved or even manifest in times of need. For instance, legends tell of Saint Celestine, a warrior woman who has fallen in battle and been reborn, claiming the Emperor sent her back for a purpose. Tales like that keep hope alive. They suggest that the Emperor truly watches over the souls of the faithful, But for the average poor guardsman or civilian, well, the warp is vast and hungry. The uncomfortable possibility is that unless you're someone really special, a saint, a primarch, a particularly strong-willed soul, you might not get that golden VIP ticket to the Emperor's side. Imperial scholars, the few who dare study souls at all, know that unprotected human souls tend to disperse or get devoured by whatever predator swims by in the warp's depths. Demons, the chaos gods, random warp entities. They all feed on soul stuff like yours. So if you die and your soul enters the warp with no protection, it could be snatched up as a snack before you can say, "Holy Throne." This grim fate is exactly why the Ecclesiarchy, the Imperial Church, pushes the Paradise narrative so hard. Faith is a shield, maybe literally. Belief in the Emperor might create a kind of psychic beacon or bond. The truly devout like to think that the Emperor, as a powerful being in the warp himself, he's basically a god at this point, whether he intended to be or not, will attract their soul like a moth to a flame, keeping it safe from the predators in the dark. There's even a strain of imperial thought that the Emperor is actively fighting for those souls, that in the storm of the warp, his spirit is like a lighthouse, and the faithful souls are drawn to it through the gale of chaos. Some go further and say that these souls merge with the Emperor, strengthening him. After all, the Emperor needs soul stuff to survive. He literally consumes 1,000 psykers a day to keep himself going. So maybe being one with the Emperor is less metaphor and more, well, becoming part of his spirit. That might not sound like your personal paradise, losing your identity in the Emperor, but to an Imperial citizen, it's far better than the alternative of being ripped apart by demons. For the Imperium's common folk, then, paradise is essentially union with the Emperor. It's the promise that their consciousness will continue, bathed in his light rather than falling into nightmare. The Imperial Creed doesn't dwell on the possibility of failure. They won't tell you in the uplifting pamphlets that if your faith wavers, or simply if you're unlucky, your soul might wander alone, confused, and get hunted by things with too many eyes and teeth. No. No. Heresy to even suggest it. So they shout all the louder. Believe. The Emperor will protect your soul. Doubt at your peril, for doubt invites damnation. Not everyone in the Imperium believes exactly the same. Many Space Marines, for example, still hold to the old Imperial truth that there's no afterlife at all. They revere the Emperor as the ultimate commander and father of mankind, but not as a literal god who will shepherd their souls. There are exceptions. Some chapters have their own legends of what comes after. The Space Wolves, for instance, boast that when they die, they'll feast and fight in the great halls of their Primarch, Leman Russ, a rowdy warrior, heaven under the eye of the All-Father, their term for the Emperor. On the flip side, the most devout Imperial servants, like the Black Templars, Space Marines, or the Sisters of Battle, fervently believe that in death, they will be united with the God Emperor and his saints in glory. Their faith is absolute that they'll find their place at his side. Meanwhile, the Adeptus Mechanicus, the tech priests, have a different take. They dream of merging with the Machine God. A tech priest might hope his mind becomes one with the great engine of knowledge, essentially achieving a digital afterlife within the Omniscia's massive data looms. In fact, many tech priests try to avoid dying entirely by replacing their frail flesh with immortal machine parts. The cult Mechanicus seeks immortality through technology rather than any spiritual heaven. And what of heretics or traitors? According to Imperial Creed, their souls are damned. Preachers love to paint lurid images of how those who stray from the Emperor's light will be torn apart by demons forever. It's a terrifying stick to accompany the Emperor's carrot. The message is clear. Stay loyal and maybe you get salvation. Stray and you will suffer eternal torment. Now, if the Emperor's promised afterlife is the carrot for humanity, chaos is the twisted alternate route, the devil's bargain. Those who forsake the Emperor and devote themselves to the ruinous powers have their own lurid visions of what comes after death. Each chaos god has a sort of paradise on offer, though outsiders would hardly call these realms paradisiacal. If you're a Kornate, a follower of Korn, the blood god, you believe that in death Korn will claim your soul, and to you that's a good thing. It means you get to fight on forever in Korn's domain, the great blood arena, battling an endless swarm of enemies and piling skulls for the skull throne. Eternal war in the warp. And remember, Korn's followers love war, is the closest thing to bliss for a berserker. Of course, you'd better have pleased Korn in life. If you were too weak or disappointing, the blood god might just take your skull and discard your soul. No endless battle, no warrior's glory, just oblivion or consumption by something nastier. Chaos isn't known for fair play or mercy. Nurgle, the plague god, offers a different kind of afterlife, one strangely cozy in its horror. Nurgle's followers lovingly call him Grandfather Nurgle because he treats them like his rotten children. In life, he eases their pain and fear by bloating them with disease. In death, they expect to be welcomed into Nurgle's garden, an otherworldly refuge of perpetual decay and regrowth. It sounds revolting to us, but to the Nurgleites it's comforting. They imagine becoming happy, pus-filled servants like plague-bearer demons, tending to cauldrons of contagion under Nurgle's gentle care. Free from pain, free from fear, eternally stagnant, that's their idea of paradise. Of course, if someone somehow displeases Nurgle, hard to do since he's pretty fond of anyone who spreads his gifts, they might just dissolve into the muck. But generally, Nurgle is considered the most welcoming of the Chaos Gods. He wants as many souls as possible and coddles them in his own disgusting but oddly loving way. Slaanesh, the Prince of Pleasure, promises experiences beyond mortal limits. A Slaaneshi cultist believes that after death, Slaanesh will keep their soul immersed in endless ecstasy. Feasts of sensation, pleasure without end. That's the sales pitch. The dark reality is rather more hellish. Those souls become playthings in Slaanesh's palace, where the line between ecstasy and agony vanishes. The follower might think they're in for an eternity of delight, but Slaanesh's idea of delight will warp and torture them in equal measure. In Slaanesh's realm, souls are kept constantly craving and never satisfied. To the cultist, it sounds like heaven. To anyone else, it's obviously a refined kind of hell. Ultimately, Slaanesh views souls as toys, and even favored playthings get broken. Tsintch, the changer of ways, is no less treacherous. His devotees yearn for knowledge, power, and the thrill of sorcery. They imagine that in death they'll become part of Tsintch's grand cosmic plan, maybe even transformed into demons of Tsintch shapeshifting, immortal entities woven from pure magic. And indeed, if a Tsintchian sorcerer has been especially useful and lucky, perhaps their soul will be remade as a spell-slinging demon in the crystal labyrinth. But Tsintch is fickle and endlessly cunning. He likely had a dozen convoluted plans for your soul before you even pledged it. Many a Tsintch follower finds out the hard way that instead of some glorious ascension, they get mutated into a mindless chaos spawn, or absorbed into Tsintch's ever-shifting mass. Change is not always good news for the changed. The joke among chaos scholars is, if you think you know what Tsintch will do with you, you're already wrong. Beyond the individual gods, many chaos worshippers dream of apotheosis, ascending to demonhood. To become a Daemon Prince is the ultimate goal for a champion of Chaos, an afterlife of actual godhood. Serve Chaos spectacularly well in life, and the Dark Gods might transform you into an immortal demon with a realm of your own. Several of the most powerful traitors in history achieved this paradise. The former Primarchs like Angron, Mortarion, and Fulgrim were elevated to demonhood and live eternally as monstrosities serving their god's will. To them, that was the promised reward, immortality, power, and a warped form of glory. For most, though, this is a distant dream. The vast majority of Chaos followers end up as faceless damned souls, not princes. Chaos may promise godhood, but it delivers damnation far more often. The seductive thing about Chaos is that it often gives you a little taste of its promises before you die. Unlike the Emperor's distant reward, Chaos will empower you here and now. A cultist of Nurgle might already feel no pain and an eerie contentment. A Slaanesi devotee experiences intoxicating excesses from the moment they join. A Kornat warrior might feel unnatural battle fury and strength on the battlefield. These are down payments on the soul, and they make the promised afterlife seem very believable. You're already living part of it. It's a powerful lure for the desperate, the downtrodden, or the ambitious. But it's a scam. Chaos is essentially fattening you up for the slaughter. Once your soul is fully in their grasp, you don't get a choice in your fate. You might become a demon, or you might just be devoured or obliterated, used up like fuel. In the end, the Chaos Gods give out very few paradises, and even those are grim and grotesque. The rest? They experience what we outsiders would unequivocally call hell. Moving on from the corruptions of Chaos, let's take a look at the Eldar, perhaps the most tragically aware of the afterlife's dangers. The Eldar, or Eldari, are an ancient and highly psychic race, and they know for a fact that paradise doesn't come easy, if at all. Long ago, in their golden age, the Eldar didn't fear death much at all. Eldar myth and history say that in ancient times, Eldar souls would naturally reincarnate. When an Eldar died, their soul would drift peacefully in the otherworldly realm and eventually be born again in a new body. Death was not the end. It was just a step in an endless cycle of lives. Pretty idyllic, right? That all ended with a catastrophe of their own making, the fall of the Eldar. The old Eldar Empire became decadent and corrupt. In their arrogance and endless pursuit of pleasure, the Eldar civilization effectively birthed a new Chaos God, Slaanesh, with their collective excess. When Slaanesh erupted into existence, the psychic shockwave destroyed most of the Eldar population in an instant. Worse, Slaanesh didn't just slaughter the Eldar, she devoured their spirits. The Eldar God of Death, and their whole reincarnation cycle, was annihilated. From that moment on, any Eldar soul that enters the warp upon death is hungrily consumed by Slaanesh, whom the Eldar now bitterly name She Who Thirsts. Understandably, this is a fate the surviving Eldar are desperate to avoid. The craft world Eldar, those who fled the fall on giant roaming starships, developed a technology and spiritual practice to cheat Slaanesh. Whenever a craft world Eldar dies, a special spirit stone on their armor captures their soul at the moment of death, preventing it from slipping into the warp. That spirit stone is then taken and interred in the craft world's infinity circuit, a psychically active network within the craft world that houses all the souls of departed Eldar, like a vast ghostly collective. Safe inside the infinity circuit, an Eldar soul can exist in a state of calm limbo, communing with the souls of ancestors and friends, protected from Slaanesh's predation. It's not true reincarnation or paradise, more like a self-made purgatory, but it is safety, and for the Eldar, that's the most important thing. some Eldar actually find a measure of peace in the Infinity Circuit. They sometimes liken it to a quiet ocean of spirits, where they can rest among the collective conscience of their people. The living can even occasionally consult these souls for guidance, essentially praying to or communing with the Infinity Circuit's consciousness. In dire times, though, the Eldar will do something quite disturbing. They will draw a soul out of the Infinity Circuit and embed it into a construct, like a Wraith Guard or Wraith Lord body, so that the dead may fight again to protect the living. Imagine being an Eldar soul finally at rest, only to be plucked out and stuck in a walking robot to go to war. It's a fate many Eldar find horrifying, yet sometimes necessary. Even in their supposed afterlife refuge, the Eldar dead know no total peace, because the war against chaos forces them back. The Eldar long for a true afterlife, and some see a glimmer of hope in their legends. They believe that all the souls in the Infinity Circuits across the galaxy are coalescing into a new god, Ennead, the god of the dead. One prophecy says that when Ennead fully awakens, this god will have the power to destroy Slaanesh, or at least shield all Eldar souls from her forever. In recent times, a radical Eldar faction called the Inari has formed around this idea. These Inari practice rites to awaken Ennead, and even momentarily brought forth an avatar of the god, called the Incarne. They preach that through Ennead, the Eldar race can achieve a kind of spiritual salvation, perhaps even restoring the cycle of reincarnation that was lost. It's a risky gamble born of desperation. But when your alternative is eternal torment, can you blame them for trying? Not all Eldar walk the same path, though. The Drukhari, or Dark Eldar, chose a far darker way to escape Slaanesh. The Dark Eldar dwell in Kom'orach, a hidden city in the Webway, a parallel dimension shielded from the warp. They discovered that if they avoid forming strong psychic imprints, essentially by not using psychic powers and staying in the Webway, Slaanesh's attention on their souls is less direct. But they have a different problem. Their souls slowly wither over time, and Slaanesh's pull is always there in the background, like gravity. To stave off having their life force consumed, the Dark Eldar regularly consume the pain and suffering of others. Through torture, murder, and generally being unspeakably cruel, they siphon vitality and replenish their own souls. It's like a spiritual battery charge. Other beings' agony fuels them. As long as they keep inflicting misery, they can live essentially forever, their souls ever refreshed and too busy to be snatched by Slaanesh. This is why the Drukhari are as horrific as they are. It's literally survival for them. They don't have a hopeful afterlife at all. If a Dark Eldar dies, their soul has no spirit stone to catch it. It will be devoured by Slaanesh, no question. Thus, they strive never to die. They prolong their lives indefinitely by any means. Some make pacts with Haemon Kuli, flesh-sculpting dark scientists, to be resurrected if their bodies are destroyed. Many have lived for millennia by perpetuating this cycle of theft and pain. To a Dark Eldar, paradise is just not dying, so they can keep enjoying their cruel delights. They've effectively traded any chance of a restful afterlife for an endless, desperate clinging to life. And you can imagine their ruling elite like Astrubal Vect have, through sheer ruthlessness, managed to endure for ages and plan to continue indefinitely by any foul means necessary. After all that heavy soul-devouring stuff, let's turn to something a bit more straightforward and oddly cheerful in its own way. The Orcs. Orcs are genetically engineered for war, and they thrive on fighting. You might expect them to have some elaborate warrior afterlife mythos, but honestly, orcs don't spend much time worrying about what comes after death. They're too busy enjoying life, which for them means an endless series of battles and good crumpin. Ask an orc about life after death, and you'll likely get a puzzled look or a big toothy grin, and a, "Huh, what's dat?" Orcs just aren't afraid of dying, and a big reason is their peculiar spiritual makeup. See, orcs collectively have their own gods, Gork and Mork, who are, as they describe, brutal but cunnin, and cunnin but brutal, respectively. They also have a powerful psychic gestalt, the Wach, energy that binds them together. When an orc dies, his little green soul doesn't shine brightly like a human's, and it's not something chaos gods find particularly appetizing. Instead, that life energy likely plunges back into the Wah field that permeates orc kind. Orc belief, to the extent they've thought it through, is that a good death in battle pleases Gork and Mork. There are hints in orc folklore that the biggest and best orcs get to join Gork and Mork in some great cosmic barroom brawl beyond the stars. Some orcs even claim, in their characteristically matter-of-fact way, that when they die, their soul gets recycled. Gork and Mork will just chuck them back down in a fresh fungal body for another go. This isn't recorded doctrine or anything. Orcs aren't exactly theologians, but it reflects their total lack of fear. An orc truly expects that the fighting will never end, in life or death, and that's absolutely fine by them. In fact, that's ideal. From an outside perspective, what likely happens is that orc souls are indeed reclaimed by the psychic might of Gork and Mork. Orc psychers, weird boys, and some Imperial xenologists suspect that orc souls merge into the collective green energy of their gods. In practical terms, orcs keep getting reborn anyway, through spores that sprout into new orcs. So even biologically, an orc's legacy is assured. Kill one and a dozen more might spring up from the ground in his place. In a sense, every orc is the afterlife of a previous orc, over and over, spawned by the eternal Wah. The bottom line is, orcs don't need a paradise. Give an orc a good fight, plenty of mates at his side, and maybe a tank or two to loot, and he's already living the dream. If he dies, he dies. There'll always be more orcs, and the war goes on. If there truly is an orc afterlife, it's probably just the great green scrap in the sky, where Gork and Mork watch their boys bash each other for fun. And if it's not real, doesn't matter. Every orc will tell you, "Oi, stop worrying and keep fighting." They'll either win and keep fighting, or die and, in their mind, fight some more in the next life. Paradise for an orc is simply an endless Wah! Next up, the Necron. Ah, Necrons, ancient, ageless, and utterly without mercy. If any beings have no paradise waiting, it's these poor metal husks. The Necrons weren't always machines. 10 million years ago, they were flesh and blood humanoids called the Necrontyre. They had a tragic existence, short, painful lives under a dying sun, and they craved immortality. In their desperation, they struck a deal with godlike cosmic entities known as the Catan, star gods. The Necrontyr agreed to undergo the biotransference, trading their frail bodies for undying mechanical forms. The cruel twist? The Catan devoured the Necrontyr's souls in the process. When the Necrontyr awoke as Necrons, they had achieved immortality, yes, but at the cost of their very selves. So the Necrons you see today are soulless automatons, or nearly so. A few retained echoes of personality. The high-ranking overlords and lords have fragments of their old minds, often corrupted by millennia of stasis and war. But none have a true soul that will drift off to an afterlife. When a Necron is finally destroyed beyond its capacity to self-repair, that's it. Lights out. No ghost. Nothing. Necrons don't need an afterlife. They intended to live forever right here. In a grim way, they got what they wanted, a form of eternal life. But it's not the paradise they hoped for. Immortality turned out to be a curse of endless monotony and madness for many Necrons. They can't truly live, they endure. Some are self-aware enough to feel profound regret. Their Silent King, the last ruler of the Necron Tier, actually felt such guilt that he exiled himself for millions of years, searching for a way to restore his people's souls. Many Necron lords obsessively collect art or wage pointless wars, perhaps trying to fill the void where their souls and mortality used to be. They gained eternity, but lost everything that made existence meaningful. An especially bitter irony is that the Necrons essentially obliterated their own gods, shattering the Catan into shards, and dominated the material universe, yet they can't enjoy a single moment of true peace. For Necrons, then, death holds no fear, but also no promise. There's no Necron heaven awaiting in the warp. Their only hope, for those few who dare to hope, is that maybe, somehow, they can reverse what was done to them. Barring that, the Necrons will simply persist until the end of time, or until someone finally puts them down for good. No afterlife, no rebirth, just an infinite hollow existence. In seeking to conquer death, they made oblivion in life their reality. Some might call that a fate worse than any demonic hell. What about the Tyranids? The Tyranids are extragalactic horrors, swarms of alien bio-organisms driven by the all-consuming hive mind. Asking a Tyranid about the afterlife is like asking a wildfire about retirement plans. Tyranids don't have individual souls the way humans or Eldar do. They're all extensions of a vast collective consciousness. A given Tyranid creature, a Hormagaunt, a Genestealer, a Carnifex, is more like a single neuron in a colossal brain. When it dies, there's no sense of personal self to carry on. Its biomass is reabsorbed by the swarm, quite literally, as other Tyranids will dissolve and reuse its body. And any scant flicker of consciousness it had is just gone or rejoined to the greater hive mind. In other words, individual Tyranids have no afterlife at all. They barely have a life to begin with. They are instruments of the hive mind's will. Does the Tyranid hive mind itself have a grand plan for after death? Not really. It doesn't acknowledge death as anything but a process. The hive mind is like an eternal predator. It exists to consume, grow, and continue. If it thought in such terms, it might consider the closest thing to paradise, the complete ingestion of all life in the galaxy, becoming the only consciousness left. But that's more of an end goal than an afterlife. For the rest of the galaxy, when Tyranids show up, they often talk about the afterlife, praying they won't become some mindless bio-slurry or begging their gods to save them from the Great Devourer. There's a grim joke among Imperial troops. If you're eaten by a Tyranid, maybe the Emperor will spare you the pain by snuffing out your soul quickly, because otherwise you might find your very essence digested in that cosmic feeding frenzy. But honestly, being eaten alive by a Tyranid is more merciful than what many Chaos Demons would do to your soul. At least it's over fast. For the Tyranids, though, the concept of paradise or damnation doesn't apply. They are beyond morality, beyond individual desire. When a hive fleet sweeps through a sector, there's no comforting spiritual narrative behind it. It's just nature at its most brutal. In a way, that's terrifying. The Tyranids won't tempt you with lies or judge your soul. They'll simply consume you, body and, if possible, soul, and use the energy to spawn more Tyranids. Oblivion is the only afterlife they offer their victims, and the Tyranids themselves neither know nor care. Now let's talk about the Toe, a young, star-faring species with big dreams and a very different outlook. The Toe Empire doesn't really promise its citizens a glorious afterlife at all. The Tau are generally secular and rational. Their guiding philosophy is the greater good, Taufa, essentially a vision of harmonious society and progress. To are taught to focus on contributing to the greater good here and now, not on what comes after death. In fact, the concept of an afterlife is almost absent from official To doctrine. To a To citizen, when you die, your deeds live on in the continued success of the empire. Your name might be remembered for your service, and that's about it. The To don't speak of souls traveling to paradise or being reborn. Culturally, they once had various spiritual beliefs, long before the current age, but the ethereal caste united them under a mostly atheistic, utilitarian ethos. They set aside old religions in favor of pure devotion to the greater good. So if you asked a To about the afterlife, they might politely explain that their consciousness will simply end, but that's all right because they live on through their contributions to society. Now, on a metaphysical level, do the To have souls? Yes, but they burn very dimly in the warp. The To are an almost psychically inert species. To human psychers, a Tao soul is barely a candle compared to the bonfire of a human soul. This means two things. One, the chaos gods and warp predators hardly notice To souls. There's not enough psychic meat to attract them. And two, when a To dies, their soul likely dissipates gently, perhaps drifting apart into the warp with little fanfare. There aren't any known To ghosts or demons, which suggests that they indeed fade out rather than persist. Ironically, this means the To might have one of the kinder fates in the galaxy, simple oblivion. No eternal torment, no hungry gods chasing them. A To who dies for the greater good can at least trust that their soul won't be snatched into some hellish realm. If anything, it will just fade. And to a To, that's not frightening, it's natural. Their focus is on the living legacy. The To view on death is very pragmatic. A fire warrior might hope that his sacrifice ensures victory in a battle, securing a better future for his people. His comrades will honor him, maybe etch his name on a memorial drone, and then continue the fight. In a way, the To make an afterlife through memory and ongoing purpose, not through supernatural means, but through the continued march of the greater good. Even some of the galaxy's lesser-known factions have their own twists on the afterlife. Take the Leagues of Votan, the Kin. These stout, pragmatic miners have no use for gods at all. They believe immortality is achieved through memory and legacy. Each League's ancestor core, a supercomputer filled with the wisdom of their forebears, keeps the knowledge of every generation. In a way, when a kin dies, their soul lives on as data and memory within the Votan core and in the minds of their living comrades. No heaven or hell, just the assurance that they won't be forgotten. It's a very down-to-earth approach to life after death. Then there are the tragic genestealer cults, human and otherwise cultists, who worship the Tyranids as divine. They actually convince themselves that when their so-called sky gods, the Tyranid High Fleet, arrive, they will be rewarded and made part of a glorious new unity. They call it ascension. In truth, ascension means being eaten alive by a big slavering bio-monster. Yet these cultists die in ecstasy, believing that being devoured is a holy rapture that joins them with their gods. It's perhaps the most ironic afterlife belief of all, a promise of paradise that literally ends in the digestive tract of an alien swarm. So is there a paradise in Warhammer 40,000's afterlife? For most, the answer is a resounding no. In this grim universe, one being's heaven is another's hell, and most souls find no peace at all. Paradise is often just a lie told to keep hope alive or armies charging. If you're looking for a merciful reward after death, you're in the wrong galaxy. Better to fight on while you live, because no one's coming to give you a happy ever after once you fall. In the grim darkness of the far future, paradise isn't just lost. It never existed to begin with.